Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's day two of the 2020 Republican National Convention. So today, we're talking with Tim Alberta, chief political correspondent for Politico. He's spent more than a decade covering the Republican Party, and his book, American Carnage, is a forensic examination of the Republican Party under President Trump. Alberta knows and talks to just about every major figure in the GOP. So you can imagine his surprise when one day a high schooler asked him a couple of simple questions. What do Republicans believe? What does it mean to be a Republican? And Alberta himself did not have a satisfying answer. So Tim Alberta went on a quest. His first stop, longtime, well-connected Republican pollster Frank Luntz. And Alberta joins us now. So, Tim, first of all, let me ask you, when you asked Luntz that question, what do Republicans believe? What was Frank Luntz's answer?
You know, he did not really have an answer. He there was a long pause. There was some searching on his side of the phone. And he said, well, you know, I don't think that you can say that it's about making America great at a time of a pandemic and social disruption and economic collapse, because that's just not credible. And then he thought some more and he said, you know, I think it's about promoting. And then he kind of stopped himself and said, no, that doesn't work. You know, no, I don't know. I don't know. That's the best I can do. And so I kept pressing him. And it's important to realize that, you know, Frank Luntz has been the preeminent Republican Party messenger for the past generation. This is someone who, through his focus groups and his polling, he has had the pulse of the Republican voter better than anyone. And it's his ability to translate that from around the country with the voters he talks with to the people in Washington who are in power. I mean, he has played such an essential role, you can't overstate it, in helping the modern Republican Party not just craft its message, but ultimately gain power. And so I continued to press him on it. And finally, he himself grew a bit exasperated and he said, look, I've tried to answer this, but I can't. I don't know the answer. For the first time in my life, I don't know the answer to this question of, you know, what does it mean to be a Republican?
And he wasn't BSing you, right? I mean, he reminds me that he's just like at a point in life where he doesn't have anything left to lose. And he was just like, I just don't know. I mean, how did that strike you that someone as well connected as Luntz also couldn't answer that question?
Well, to be honest, at first it struck me as reassuring, because I was starting to question whether I had lost my edge and whether I was sort of asleep at the switch. Because, you know, like Frank, I've spent really my entire professional career studying Republican voters, studying Republican politicians, immersing myself in the world of Republican politics. And, you know, to not have a good answer to the question, the very, very elementary question of, you know, what do Republicans believe? What does it mean to be a Republican? You know, if an alien landed here from another planet and asked you that question, you'd think that you would have a decent answer, but I really didn't. And so Frank, of all people, I expected that he would certainly have something by way of a reasonable, respectable answer, but he didn't either. And at first I thought, well, good, at least I'm in good company. But then of course it throws you even deeper down the rabbit hole, trying to get your arms around what is suddenly, I think, becoming apparent to me to be a really important question and one that maybe we don't have a good answer to.
So you write about this quest that you underwent to find the answers to these questions about what does it mean to be a Republican? And you had a big piece out in Politico just yesterday called The Grand Old Meltdown, What Happens When a Party Gives Up on Ideas. And I just want to let folks know that we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. And of course, Tim, this question comes at a very, very important time, because here we are in the middle of the Republican National Convention, and there's so many pieces to what we heard yesterday and what we will hear that I want to dig into with you. But before we leave Frank Luntz and your phone conversation with him, I got to ask, was your next question to him, after sort of both of you sat with your mutual inability to answer, what does it mean to be Republican? Did you ask him, like, is that a problem that there isn't an answer right now?
So I don't think I asked him that, but it was understood, and we both had a chuckle at his inability to answer it, because I told him of my own inability to answer it, and we shared a laugh over it. And I think in that laugh, it was, you know, certainly understood that this is not ideal for a party to, you know, 3 months, less than 3 months from Election Day, to be so intellectually ambiguous and to have so little in the way of concrete policy plans. You know, honestly, I can't remember a time in my life, and Frank said the same, that you just struggled so manifestly to come up with any sort of a coherent definition or description for a party. And so we laughed about it. And obviously, I don't have skin in this game. Frank does. He's a longtime Republican, and he sounded pretty worried about it. And as did, you know, many, many other people that I spoke with in the course of reporting this piece.
Okay. So curious or gentle pushback, let me say, that pops into my mind is, well, there actually is a coherent internal definition of the GOP, and we heard it last night in any number of speeches that were given in day one of the Republican National Convention. So let's just listen to some excerpts of some of the speeches from last night.
You have used your strength to make America strong again. Sacrificed the life you built to make America proud again. And you risked everything to make America safe again.
President Trump believes in you. He emancipates and lifts you up to live your American dream.
Mr. President, lead the way. Millions in our American family believe in this path to destiny. Guide us to that horizon.
So that was Natalie Harp, Kimberly Guilfoyle, and Sean Parnell last night at the RNC. Tim, I mean, obviously, the internal coherence of the Republican Party now takes the shape of Donald Trump. Isn't that what it means to be a Republican now, to follow President Trump?
Yes. I think that's about as concise and also about as accurate of a definition as there is. And, you know, I wrote in the piece for Politico yesterday that there is no disputing the fact that in that sense, the Republican Party is the very definition of a cult of personality, that it is not an entity built around ideas. It is not an entity built around you know, philosophical principles. There is no great organizing principle of the party. The organizing principle of the party is fidelity to Trump. And you know, I can go back to the earliest days after he won the Republican primary, before he had even won the general election, and talking with members of Congress about, you know, their hesitancy to cross him, including members of Congress who had been highly critical and who had been outspoken about his behavior and his rhetoric, but who suddenly were beginning to fall very silent. And the conversations I had then foreshadowed the next 4 years of their relationship with Trump. And they all would say something to the same effect, which is that once they spent some time back home in their districts with their constituents, with the base, talking with these people, they came to understand that Trump had this almost supernatural connection with them, and that their loyalty to this president was stronger than any loyalty that they had ever had to their local officials, themselves included, and that the only thing that they could compare it to was a cult. If I had this conversation once, I had to have had it 24 times. And what you began to see after Trump won the nomination, after he won the presidency, after he took office, it has only been strengthened day by day by day, that intensity of feeling that so many Republican voters have for him. And as a result, their elected representatives, they show that same fidelity. They show that same intensity. They dare not expose any daylight between themselves and the president. And that has kept them in the president's good graces. It is, you know, sustained their standing within the Republican Party, but it has come at the expense of facilitating any sort of a real vision for governing beyond just showing that fidelity to the president.
And I think that we saw the clearest example of that in the run-up to this week's convention, right, where the party, the Republican National Committee, decided not to have a 2020 party platform. Now, just as a little bit of a little recent historical primer, if I have this right, on June 10th, the executive committee actually voted first to adopt the old 2016 platform, right? So they weren't going to come up with any new ideas from what they had 4 years ago. Then the president tweeted and said he wanted some kind of new platform. So instead, the RNC decided, well, they were just going to not have a platform and adopt whatever the president's agenda was. So a formal and public declaration from the party itself that there were going to be no new ideas to thrash out during this convention, and instead it was just going to be following President Trump's agenda. We've got to take a quick break, Tim, but when we come back, I want to get your response to that. So we're talking with Tim Alberta this hour about what the Republican Party stands for. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's day two of the Republican National Convention, and I'm joined today by Tim Alberta. He's chief political correspondent for Politico, and he's written a big new piece in Politico about what has happened to the Republican Party and the ideas that once defined it. We have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Tim's also author of American Carnage, On the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. So, Tim, give us your take on the significance, or what does it mean that there is no official 2020 Republican platform this year?
You know, it's interesting, Meghna. I had started to report this piece earlier in the summer when it was not at all clear that there would not be a new Republican platform. And once that decision was made to initially just renew the 2016 platform and then to drop it altogether and just not have a party platform for 2020, you know, I thought to myself, boy, sometimes the work is really hard, but sometimes it's really easy. Sometimes it just comes right to you. And this is one of these moments. I mean, because there's nothing symbolically richer in making the argument, as I do in the piece, about the sort of intellectual vacuum in the Republican Party and how the party has become, you know, willfully, deliberately untethered from ideas. There's nothing that can so aptly demonstrate that as the dropping of the party platform altogether. And on the one hand, sure, a party platform is often just a sort of exercise in projecting. It is not a document that governs the party's every move. It is a statement of principles and philosophies and ideologies. That's true. On the other hand, there is a reason that, you know, hundreds and hundreds of party officials gather over a period of months and really fight, in many cases, fight ferociously with one another mm-hmm. over every bit of grammar and every turn of phrase in that party platform, because it does represent something and it does go into the history books. I mean, you can go back and find party platforms going back decades and decades and decades. I mean, this is something that is meant to stand the test of time as a snapshot of right. what a party was fighting for during an election year. And Republicans this year, they don't have anything to show for it.
Right. I mean, even in the 2020 Democratic platform, you see evidence of that sort of thrashing out of policy, that fight between, you know, the progressive and moderate factions of the DNC and of the Democratic Party, I should say. And, you know, I mean, I suppose if we were to interrogate Democrats, too, they might have some difficulty in expressing exactly what Democrats stand for. But to your point, Tim, at least they're having those in the context of their convention, had that rigorous debate. I mean, that's the difference. There is no debate on the Republican side, or at least in terms of this platform. So what I really want to hear from you more, Tim, or what some of the lifelong Republicans told you about what they think their party's reason for being even is right now, then. I mean, for example, you talked to Brendan Buck. First of all, for people who don't know him, who is he?
So Brendan Buck is, I think, arguably the most well-known senior congressional staffer to the Republicans on Capitol Hill over the past decade. He served as the top advisor to Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, and he was also a top deputy to the previous Republican Speaker of the House, John Boehner. So this is someone who's very well-known in Washington circles.
And what did he tell you?
Well, my conversation with Brendan was pretty short, and he didn't need to do the same sort of soul searching that Frank Luntz did. Brendan took my question and kind of scoffed and said, "Owning the libs and pissing off the media. That's what we believe in now. That's what the Republican Party's all about. There's not much more to it than that." And, you know, for that is, for some of your listeners who may be scratching their heads, that is shorthand. You know, owning the libs, it has become the sort of colloquialism inside the Republican Party for this idea that anything that offends or irritates or alienates liberals or Democrats, progressives, anything that effectively throws up a flag that, you know, on social media or elsewhere, anything that is sort of seen as a cultural wedge issue, then that is something Republicans will embrace. And you see that almost every day if you log on to Twitter or if you're watching Fox News. I mean, it has become central to the Republican DNA, this idea of, you know, snowflakes and cancel culture and anything that, you know, that Republicans can do to sort of get under the skin of the left, they will embrace it as not just as an abstract way of getting their kicks, but as a way to advance their political aims. And so that was one thing that Brendan identified. And then the second thing he said, as far as pissing off the media, look, there's no question that, the sustained, consistent fight against the press has gone from a sideshow of the Republican Party to center stage. It is very much a central component of the modern Republican political strategy to not only point out instances of alleged bias and unfairness in the press, but to actively treat the press as partisan combatants and to rally the support of the Republican base behind them for the purpose often of discrediting what these people may be hearing from the mainstream media, because they know that often what they're hearing from the mainstream media is going to paint the Republican Party in a bad light. So if they can undermine the messenger, if they can delegitimize the messenger, then the sting will be taken out of the message itself. And so those are the two things that identifies as being the two key elements of the modern Republican Party's sort of existence.
So, Tim, I've got to say, it is what you're describing. I'm almost at a loss for words, because it is such a tragic diminishment of an American political party. Republicans still call themselves the Party of Lincoln. Now, the Party of Lincoln at one time stood for ideas. It stood for the preservation of the Union. It stood for the abolishment of slavery. Those were deep, profound American ideas. More modern versions of the Republican Party were pretty clear about the ideas that it stood for, right? Like a market-based economy, smaller government, entitlement reform. I mean, you could balance budgets amendment, term limits. You could name any number of set of ideas that were core tenets of the Republican Party. And what you're describing now is a complete elimination of any one of those things that you could point to and say, as a conservative, this is what I stand for. I mean, just to hear Brendan Buck say, owning the libs and pissing off the media, there's really not much more to it. I mean, how profound of a collapse is this?
The word collapse is what comes to mind, and I don't think there's really any disputing it. And,
it doesn't even sound like Republicans. It doesn't even sound like internal operatives in the party right now are disputing it.
No. And again, the decision to drop the platform, as I said a minute ago, I mean, sometimes these things just sort of write themselves and they just fall into your lap. And that was largely the case here. Look, if you have a party that announces, nah, we don't need a platform. We don't need a statement of our vision. We don't need a statement of our principles. We don't need a statement of our sort of even our most aspirational, unrealistic goals. We don't need to put them on paper, because nobody needs to know. What they need to know is that we are in power and that we support the guy in power, and that what he's doing is the right thing, and we're going to keep supporting him. I mean, that's it. You can't overstate just how vacuous that is. And look, I think, just speaking as someone who's covered this for a long time, I think it's important to recognize that you have the broad strokes of conservative Republicanism, the core tenets that have been meant to inform the party's governance over a period of decades and decades. So, yes, limited government and free enterprise and, family values, global leadership. I mean, certainly those are the bedrock principles of Republicanism. And moreover, within that pretty broad construct, you have seen these specific policy ideas really animate previous iterations of the Republican Party. The previous Republican president, George Bush, his entire campaign for president in 2000, and of course this was pre-9/11, but his entire campaign was about compassionate conservatism. And that meant reforming the education system to help poor kids stuck in bad schools in the inner cities. It meant a massive program focused on refugee resettlement to show that America is still that beacon of hope for people around the world who are desperate for freedom. It meant prisoner reentry programs to help the overloaded and overworked prison system, help rehabilitate the people who were going to be coming back into society, and to make sure that these people could have jobs and that they could raise families and that they could be productive members of society. You look at those parts and then they added up to a whole, and that whole that they added up to was part of an even bigger whole. I mean, in other words, there were levels of policy and of planning and of platform, and it all was sort of meant to tie together. And obviously you had the same under Ronald Reagan. You had the same under even Barry Goldwater. There were principles here, and there were not just abstract principles, but there were ideas to advance those broader principles. What you see now is not only have the principles themselves really faded almost to a point of being unrecognizable, but there are just no specific ideas. There are no big policies to advance and to hold up to voters and say, we have a vision for fixing these problems. We have a vision for improving your lives.
Okay. So hold that thought, Tim, because I want to come back to it. It's very, very important. But in terms of the profound collapse or the meltdown or the out of control roller coaster, as you write about it in your piece in Politico, I just want to use another example here. So first of all, let's talk a little bit about the transformation of Lindsey Graham, Senator Lindsey Graham. Here he is on Fox News in February of 2016.
I'm not going to try to get into the mind of Donald Trump. I think he's a kook. I think he's crazy. I think he's unfit for office. And I'm a Republican and he's not. He's not a conservative Republican. He's an opportunist.
And here's Senator Lindsey Graham on CNN in November of 2017.
You know what concerns me about the American press is this endless, endless attempt to label the guy as some kind of kook, not fit to be president.
So those two pieces of tape are roughly a year, just over a year and a half apart, Tim. I mean, what does it tell you? What does it tell you that even these sort of rock solid once pillars of the Republican Party, like Graham, have made this profound turn? I mean, are they some of the people that you write about that see Trump as the salvation for the party, or are they the ones who just are like closing their eyes and not wanting to look at what's happening? I mean, what's going on?
Well, I hate to be overly simplistic about this, but let me offer this insight. For elected officials, people, particularly at the federal level, who have tasted great influence and great authority and great proximity to power, they are, in most cases, in 9 out of 10, and probably in 99 out of 100, they are desperate to hold on to that power. It really is often as simple as that. And if that means changing your position on a policy, if that means making amends with someone that you were previously at odds with, if it means blatantly and almost cartoonishly contradicting yourself, then you're going to do it. And for anyone who watches these before and after clips, whether it be Lindsey Graham, whether it be Marco Rubio, whether it be Ted Cruz, whether it be Rick Perry, Rand Paul, I mean, you go up and down the list, you know, you could be excused for wondering, what on earth is going on here? How could someone say these two things in such a short space of time about the exact same subject that are 180 degrees different and diametrically in conflict with one another? And I think the answer to it is pretty plain, that self-preservation is the name of the game. And in today's Republican Party, if you are going to survive, if you are going to retain your influence and that proximity to power that I spoke about, you cannot be anything other than completely loyal to President Trump. And this, at the risk of repeating ourselves, this goes back to the earlier point. Into that intellectual vacuum that we've been discussing, there is really only one thing that fills it, and that is fidelity to the president, no matter what.
I mean, in your piece, you call it a form of a political nihilism.
I can't think of another way to describe it. And it's not, you know, to be clear, it's not just the attitudes toward Trump and the sort of unwavering loyalty to Trump. It's the inability to call out and speak up against the sort of behavior from people across the party that these folks would have once been completely disgusted by, and that if they were practiced by a Democrat, that they would be shouting from the rooftops about anarchy and about the collapse of our political system. It's that silence, that complicity, that's every bit as telling.
Well, we are talking about the Republican Party and its core, or now perhaps hollow core, of founding ideas. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're talking with Tim Alberta of Politico. He has published a big piece in Politico just yesterday called The Grand Old Meltdown: What Happens When a Party Gives Up on Ideas. And Tim has been following and reporting on the Republican Party for years. And, you know, Tim, before we get sucked too far into being Cassandras predicting the doom of the GOP, let's just have a little check here, because last night, in night one of the Republican National Convention, we also saw Ambassador Nikki Haley and Senator Tim Scott at the tail end of the night giving two by far, I think, the best speeches of the night, hearkening perhaps back to the Republican Party President Donald Trump, and perhaps hearkening forward, if I could put it that way. I mean, especially I think in Tim Scott's speech, to what the party could be again. So all is not yet lost, is it?
No, it's not. And look, there's no point in being alarmist to the extent of, you know, writing off a party forever, because any casual study of American politics, American history, demonstrates quite clearly that these coalitions are constantly shifting, that the very nature of a two-party system sort of demands a pretty constant self-correction from the out-of-power party. And, you know, so in one sense, Trump's victory in 2016 was made all the more incredible by the fact that following the party's loss in 2012, there was this Republican autopsy and a call for the party to diversify and to soften its rhetoric and to reach out beyond its white base and be more inclusive, more aspirational. And of course, Donald Trump comes along and crumples up that plan, lights it on fire, and winds up winning the presidency. And so we all have such short memories that there's an instinct to believe that that's the new Republican vision for winning elections. And in fact, what Trump probably did was just postpone the inevitable. And most smart Republicans who are being honest will admit that. And so when Donald Trump leaves office, whether it's after the 2020 election or after the 2024 election or under some other set of circumstances that we can't quite see at this point, there is going to burst out into the open this internal reckoning that it's already begun behind closed doors. Because when you listen to a Tim Scott or you listen to a Nikki Haley, you can hear some subtle hints of that future and of that mandate to make sure that this is a party that, while attending to some of those populist concerns that President Trump was able to use so effectively in 2016 to rile the conservative base, that you have to do more, that you have to expand the party, that you have to broaden your appeal, and that you have to offer more in the way of concrete ideas and solutions. And so that's what you're going to hear from some of those ambitious younger Republicans who are already beginning to look past the Trump presidency.
Well, since we've mentioned Senator Tim Scott, let's just listen to a little bit of his speech last night from the RNC, where he spoke a great deal about his own family's history. And he talked about his grandfather, who had to leave school in the third grade to pick cotton. And here's what Senator Scott said.
Our family went from cotton to Congress in one lifetime. And that's why I believe the next American century can be better than the last. There are millions of families just like mine all across this nation, full of potential, seeking to live the American dream. And I'm here tonight to tell you that supporting the Republican ticket gives you the best chance of making that dream a reality.
That's Republican Senator Tim Scott at the Republican National Convention last night. But Tim, Alberta, of course, as you describe, the Tim Scotts of the party are fewer and far between. More vocal are these voices telling you that, like, there's no sort of ideological values or principle or ideas driven core to the party anymore. And to that point, I want to play another speech that happened recently from another Republican. This is Jeff Flake, the former senator who served for 18 years in Congress as a Republican from Arizona. Now, of course, he did not seek re-election in 2018. And yesterday, he released a video endorsing Joe Biden for president. And here is what Jeff Flake said.
Can any of us stand here today and claim that our party has remained faithful to the conservative principles during the president's time in office? No, we cannot. If we are honest, there is less of a conservative case to be made for reelecting the president than there is just a blatant appeal for more rank tribalism and further division and more willful amnesia in the face of more outlandish presidential behavior. I cannot and will not be a part of that. There is simply no future in it.
It's former Senator Jeff Flake. So, Tim Alberta, this is that bursting out into the open that you're talking about here. But how many people that you know of who are significant movers and shakers in the Republican Party would agree with Flake that there's no future in this approach that the GOP has decided to take?
Well, I would answer that question by drawing a distinction between the folks who would acknowledge it publicly with a camera rolling or with a recorder running versus those who would acknowledge it privately in an off-the-record setting, maybe with a couple of Bud Lights on the table between you. And the latter is a pretty large number, actually. And I'll be careful not to name names, but let me just put it this way. If you were to sit down with, you know, 50 of the most recognizable public-facing members of Congress and have this conversation with them about the sustainability of this approach, about the demographics of America and the challenges that confront a party that is drawing its practically its entire electoral life force from the white vote, I would say that 40 of those 50 would tell you, yeah, this is trouble. This is really bad, and it's getting worse, and we've got to do something about this. But I'm sure not going to put my neck on the line right now and make any sort of dramatic, bold statement that's going to put a bullseye on my back, because most of these folks, it's important to realize, they consider themselves sort of long-term, three-dimensional chess players. They want to be a part of that next iteration of the Republican Party. They want to be around long enough so that they can help to craft the solutions. And to them, you know, wanting to be around justifies the silence and the enabling of Trump in this moment, because it's going to help them keep their jobs. But, you know, you mentioned Jeff Flake, and we heard from him and talked about how there's no future in this. I mean, quite literally for Jeff Flake, there is no future because he lost his job over it. Jeff Flake lost his job in the U.S. Senate despite being one of the, if not the very most conservative Republican on Capitol Hill over the previous two decades. He lost his job because he spoke out against the president.
So, Tim, I've just got to jump in here because I'm really glad you made that point. That was almost exactly what I was going to say, because while there might be some sort of self-satisfying romance in the idea of being part of the future team that helps the GOP rise like a phoenix from the ashes, a couple of things are going on at the same time. It's both the party and the republic, which is burning down to perhaps form those ashes. I would say that comes at a very, very, very great cost. And secondly, I mean, the Jeff Flake speech yesterday was not at the RNC, I should just underscore, but the statement that he made, I had to grit my teeth a little bit, because to your point, he sat in a Senate for years, being one of the most reliably conservative senators there. And President Trump is not the cause. I would argue that he's the symptom. The cause is what you were saying earlier in the show, Tim, which is a long-term, relentless pursuit of power. And I think actually even Republican leadership in the form of Mitch McConnell in the Senate is the perfect embodiment of that. And Jeff Flake was a reliable vote with Mitch McConnell's agenda. There was no, you know, they wanted to take down the ACA. They never put up a competing idea of what they would replace it with. I'm also thinking of Michael Steele now, the former RNC chairman who has joined the Lincoln Group. I mean, back in 2010, he proudly led the Republican National Committee to help, you know, sweep in all those the Tea Party Republicans into the House. And now he's acting surprised, like the same people that they gave the tools to break down the systems are actually using those tools. I mean, I don't understand why they think that there's they could be part of a future solution to the party where they themselves are part of the reason why the GOP has arrived where it is today.
Well, you're absolutely right. And it's so foundationally important for any examination of Donald Trump's presidency and this era of our crazy, asymmetrical, disrupted politics to understand that this is not about Trump, ultimately, that Trump is not the cause. He's the consequence. He is the symptom, to your point. Trump's ascent and Trump's ultimate takeover of the Republican Party was invited. You know, I always come back to this quote that I used in a story, a long feature story I wrote about John Boehner after he retired, and I used it in my book as well to demonstrate this. We were talking about this period of Boehner's speakership where he allowed the Tea Party renegades in his conference to push the government into a shutdown over this idea of defunding Obamacare, which was logistically impossible. They couldn't do it. All they could do was force a government shutdown to prove that they wanted to do it, but they couldn't actually, you know, do anything about the policy. And then, you know, in that same summer, there was this massive fight over immigration, and it was the closest the U.S. had come in decades and decades to actually passing a real substantive overhaul of the nation's immigration system, something that was had bipartisan support in the Senate. And at the last minute, House Republicans got really cold feet, and Boehner did not push forward with it because he was scared about losing his job. He was scared about being overrun by those Tea Party conservatives. And we talked about those two big episodes, but any number of others that were sort of central to this slow creeping sense that the inmates were beginning to run the asylum. And ultimately, they did run John Boehner out of power. He did lose his job as Speaker of the House in a sort of coup d'etat. And the moral of the entire story, as Boehner's chief of staff put it to me at the time, he said, look, you can slice and dice this 100 different ways, but ultimately we fed the beast that ate us. And I think that that is about as appropriate a metaphor for this last 10 to 15 years of Republican politics as you could hope to find.
So what did the Republicans that you spoke to over the long period of time that you spent reporting this piece, what did they tell you about the impact this is having on the country, not just on the party, but that the collapse of an internal set of ideas, of animating ideas for the Republican Party, that is having an effect on America? What impact did they think, or did they tell you privately that they think that impact is?
You know, that's not something that most of these folks are well, when you say the impact on America, I think this is where it's important to draw a distinction, because for all of the warm and fuzzy talk about no red states and no blue states and no red districts and blue districts, you know, we live in such a siloed and fragmented country now, politically and culturally and geographically and otherwise. You are just far less likely today to live in a purple congressional district than you were 20 years ago. You are far less likely to live in a neighborhood that is politically dynamic and diverse than you were 10 years ago. I mean, those are just facts of political science. And so when you talk to Republican officials, they are almost always, even the really reasonable, pragmatic, forward-looking ones, they are still going to process most of this through the eyes of their voters back home. And politicians are reactionaries in most cases. They're not leaders. They are reacting to what they see and hear back home. And so when we talk about the Republican Party not having a platform, not having ideas, being content to essentially fall back on these cultural fights and this fidelity to President Trump, they're not doing that because it's, you know, they're not doing that in spite of what they hear back home. They're doing it because of what they hear back home. And so this question of, you know, what is the impact on America? Clearly, they believe that the impact on their constituents, on the America that they know, is perfectly acceptable. That sure, maybe these fights aren't they aren't improving tangibly the livelihoods of their constituents, but they're certainly right, giving their constituents what they want. Many of their constituents are even more fed up with the left, even more angry with the media, even more aggrieved by the loss of culture and what they see as an America right, that no longer holds its value system.
But Tim, I've just got 30 seconds left with you. The vocal members of the party who are now outside the party center, like Mark Sanford, they're saying that this disintegration of the GOP, he told you, you keep going this way of the cult of personality, you will kill our republic. Just last 10 seconds to you on that.
That's one view of it, and that's one extreme view of it. The other view is represented by Arthur Brooks, who said, look, this stuff comes and goes. It's constantly changing. Don't worry that much, at least not yet.
Well, Tim Alberta is chief political correspondent for Politico. His big piece on the collapse of the ideas within the Republican Party, we've got it linked to it at onpointradio.org. Tim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
This is On Point.